The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Are you unhappy with your health and catch everything doing the rounds? Do you have a mystery illness the doctors can't treat? Are you searching for a better way to manage your health? My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session. For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
Hello and welcome to the Yes to Life show, in which, as usual, we'll be discussing some aspect of integrative medicine for cancer. I'm Robin Daly, regular show host and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which helps people with cancer to understand and access integrative medicine. My guest this week is a very unusual cancer researcher who's stepped out to try making a difference to the way people with cancer are treated. Vary Morris is also a biochemistry lecturer at Loughborough and runs Essential Cancer Education, which aims to improve the communication skills of oncology staff. I'm speaking to Vary over Skype.
Good morning, Vary. Thank you very much for coming on the Yes to Life show today.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Robin.
So I'd say it's pretty unusual for a cancer researcher to pull off the white coat, step out of the lab, and set out to do something that would make a difference to patients' lives, albeit indirectly, to quote from your website. So what made you want to take this unusual step?
Multiple reasons. I think I've been doing cancer research for nearly 20 years now, and right from the off, I would have comments from friends and family saying things like, oh, you do such a noble job. And I felt like a fraud because I felt like I wasn't doing anything particularly noble at all. And then as the years wore on, I wanted to do something more, but I wasn't quite sure what that would look like. And I'd done the usual running a 5K and a 10K here and there to raise money for charity. But it wasn't enough. And then when I started working at Loughborough University just over 2 years ago, and I'm in the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences, I was strongly encouraged to find a sport and or exercise angle to my research. Mm. And so that's when it really opened up this world of integrative oncology to me, because I think, and I'm almost ashamed to admit this, but naively I thought up until that point, you get cancer, you get given a drug, you either get better or you don't, and that's that. I knew a bit about diet, but I didn't really think anything about exercise and all the other complementary and alternative therapies that are available. But when I started looking into it, that's when I started to grow a bigger interest in it. And as part of my enterprise activities, I thought I could do this to generate a bit of research income, but also to increase like the impact that the university's work has. And then it kind of led me down this path.
Excellent. Well, very exciting. And I noticed you came along to our conference last year. Any comments about what you heard that day?
Oh, it was very eye-opening. I met you, actually. I had a chat with Patricia Pete in the corridor over one of the breaks, and she introduced me to you. I think the big take-home for me that day was the difference between the American healthcare system and the UK health system, and how almost complementary alternative therapies are more readily accepted in the States because people pay for their own healthcare, so they can choose that option.
Right.
But yet it's quite closed down to it in terms of the traditional medicine is quite, there's a almost like a divide, a great divide between the conventional and the complementary therapies.
Absolutely. And that's what we're working all the time to cross, because it's a nightmare for people with cancer, of course. They don't care about the war between these two factions. They actually just want to find some stuff to help them.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very good. Okay, well, anyway, just to say, this year's conference, double whammy. It's a whole weekend. The first day on Saturday is going to be completely devoted to the latest on nutrition and cancer. And the second day is going to be devoted to cheap, safe, effective, non-invasive techniques for cancer that our NHS, I think, should be doing. So. Not to be missed. So, you commit the heinous crime of openly admitting something that most of us non-scientists, and I suspect quite a swathe of scientists as well, already knew that some science textbooks can be stuffy or even boring. And you set out to do something about this with your own textbook, I believe.
Yes, it's a very short ebook that's available for free on Amazon. I'm actually in the process of updating it for the second edition to include some more information, more up-to-date information. But it started as a pedagogic thing for, I was teaching cancer biology to second year students, and I was giving them this paper to read, and none of them were reading it. When I asked them why they wouldn't read it, they said, well, I've no idea what it says. It didn't make any sense. It's like reading a foreign language. And so I started experimenting with writing bits in blog posts and getting them, I'd set that as their pre-reading before the lecture. Then I'd deliver the lecture, so they'd already been introduced to the really complex terminology. And then we'd deliver the lecture, and then after the lecture, they would go and read the paper. And they found this, like, revolutionary, I think, for them. They found it really helpful at breaking down the science and the jargon.
Right. Okay, fantastic. Well, the umbrella title you give to your efforts, which are to change the way cancer is treated, is Essential Cancer Education, with a strapline,
yes,
communicating cancer clearly. So that's obviously what you're talking about there. So who is your initiative aimed at?
Anyone who works directly with cancer patients. So I call them cancer professionals. This could be, and is not exclusively an exhaustive list, but it could be occupational therapists, physiotherapists, nutritional therapists, counsellors, psychotherapists. Could be anyone, really, who has a direct role, oncology nurses, a direct role with cancer patients.
All right, okay.
And survived.
All right, well, I'm a great advocate for plain English in oncology, and although it's not always easy, it is generally possible to communicate complex information in an accessible way. Traditionally, oncologists really haven't seen the need to educate their patients. They've simply told them what they need to do. And, of course, many still work that way. So why do you think it's important for patients to understand the thinking behind their treatment options?
Well, I think we live in an age of Dr. Google, where patients will quite readily look up on the internet what's wrong with them and what treatment they're going to have and what it's going to entail. And I think there's a lot of information out there that's bogus and or unhelpful. And I think if there's also this power dynamic, isn't there, between the health professional and the patient. We go to them saying, oh, I don't know what's wrong with me, cure me, fix me, you know, give me whatever you need to give me. And we hand our power over to them. Whereas I think nowadays people are much more wanting to feel empowered and want to make their own choices and want to know all the facts before they make that decision for them. Because we're all unique, right? One size does not fit all. You touched upon this in previous episodes where you talk about personalised medicine as well.
Yes.
But I think, we're moving into an age where just giving our power across to the health professionals is not necessarily what patients want to do. Health professionals, if they want to get their patients on board, really need to know and understand how to empower them to help.
Well, it's an interesting change, isn't it? We're sort of partway there. To a large degree, I think it's sort of age dependent, you know, how much people want to hand their power over and how much they don't. You know, largely speaking, the younger people are, the less inclined they are to do that, and the more inclined to take a personal interest and get out there and find out for themselves they are, which to me is a very healthy move. But as I say, it seems to be a change that's coming.
Yeah. A few years ago, I had I was involved in a research project with the Teenage Cancer Trust units based at the Leicester Royal Infirmary and the QMC Hospital in Nottingham.
Yeah.
And we were exploring the idea of doing some personalised 3D printed tumour models. So they'd be plastic models of your tumour.
Really?
We were asking these young people who were between the ages of 18 and 25 how they felt about this. And it was quite interesting because a lot of them felt that they weren't necessarily offered to see their scans or anything like that, but they wished they had been able to, and sometimes they would ask and they were almost treated like they weren't able to understand what was going on with them.
You're
and
right.
They really wanted to know. But you're right, it's absolutely an age-dependent thing, I think, like a parabolic curve.
It's a curious situation because, of course, the outcome of the treatment, it doesn't really matter that much to anyone other than the person who's being treated. I mean, that's what it's all about. But in a way, it's really they can be missed out of the picture completely.
Yeah, and it's their body.
Exactly. So Presenting material in plain English is central to enabling non-scientists to make informed decisions about their own healthcare, something that's right at the heart of our mission at Yes to Life. This shows a prime example. Yeah, we're always trying to put across sometimes very complex scientific ideas in a way which is accessible. So it's brilliant to have you as a guest. In this vein, you're developing a new initiative which you're calling Clarity in Cancer. Could you tell us what it's going to be and what you hope to achieve with it?
So Clarity in Cancer, I launched in February this year, and I've got my first cohort of students who've just finished the course now. So it's an online training programme for health professionals who work with cancer patients. And I've been working with people who are osteopaths, counsellors, people who run their own charity, somebody who was a cancer survivor herself and is now doing coaching for other people who are going through cancer. And it's a six-module programme, three-step programme, that goes through everything from your role as a coach in working with your cancer patients through to the psychology of a diagnosis and all the impact that has not only on the patient but also their family and loved ones, a little bit about the biology of cancer, and of course the evidence base behind the different complementary and alternative therapies as well as the conventional treatments that they have available. And then with all that information, we also look at some of the causal factors, the things, the diet and lifestyle factors that we can change to reduce our risk of secondaries. And with all that, they put it together to build a framework to help their patients to engage in their own positive health behaviour changes.
Well, look, that sounds amazing. Sounds like, oh, yes, please. You know, from our point of view, it sounds really brilliant. But funnily enough, even though it all sounds like complete common sense from a certain point of view, it's actually very radical what you're doing there, isn't it? Are you meeting opposition to what you're doing in any way?
Not so far, no.
Very good. And who is being attracted to actually learning about all this?
What I'm finding is it tends to be people who have either had cancer themselves or a loved one has had cancer, and so they have got almost like an enhanced motivation to learn and do more about this. People who have been through the system and have felt let down by the system. I'm not criticising the NHS at all. They are wonderful and do fantastic work. I think their resources are constrained, and given that, they do an awful lot of good work with that. But I think there is room for improvement in everything, isn't there? And I think where there is room for improvement is in the communication.
Right. Well, I love having somebody focusing on this particular issue. I mean, of course, we hear about this all the time at Yes to Life, our helpline. We're talking to people all the time and hearing their stories. You know, a very important part of what we do is simply to listen. And people have got some shocking stories to tell about incredibly poor communications. And I think it's very low on the priority lists within oncology. But actually, it's of key importance to somebody's fundamental feeling of being safe, cared for properly, and that the very best is being done for them. So I'm really heartened to hear that you're focusing in on that one particular issue.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely at the heart of what I do, because I think at the end of the day, cancer doesn't discriminate. It can get anyone, right? But we are all people, first and foremost. We have a humane spirit that needs to be looked after and nurtured. Very easy when you have a busy life and you've got a very, very busy schedule to almost forget that. Because when you work with people who've got cancer every single day, I'm not saying you go numb to it, but it becomes more familiar and every day for you. Whereas for somebody who's just been diagnosed with cancer, it's still a brand new set of circumstances, and it's shocking and scary for them. And I think it's important to never forget that.
I think you're absolutely right. And there's a huge gulf in a way between this being your job and you're dealing with people, sometimes incredibly short appointments. One person comes in the door, the next one. And you having to manage that in some way yourself. And as you say, this is a life-size episode for each one of those people that comes in the door, probably. And of course, the amazing disjunction between those two views of the same situation. And it's a difficult one to cross in many ways.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look, I'm very pleased that efforts are being made in this direction. It's beginning to become a kind of worldwide movement. I know that Dr. Robin Youngson, who I've had on the show before, has been doing amazing work in bringing this kind of thing to people's attention all around the planet. And you're mm-hmm. also working hard in this way. And I think, you know, something has to give soon. And it certainly has already given in many areas of healthcare, I think. It's changing quite rapidly. I tend to feel that oncology is always at the back of the queue with this kind of stuff for some reason. It's more, I don't know what the word is, it's more kind of, funny enough, it's a kind of harder hospital environment, tougher than other diseases, I think.
I wonder if that's because it's such a devastating disease that people feel they have to be hardened to be able to cope with it and work in that field. But
I think that's a big part of it. I think you're right. I think the picture needs to develop because the part of that is built on the conception of cancer as a kind of you get it or it gets you kind of war, which is how it's been portrayed for the last, 100 years or more. But actually it's becoming less and less true. And, we know at Yes to Life is that, of course, lots of people live with cancer extremely well for a long time.
Yeah.
So it's beginning to become more of a disease not to be so feared, but to become empowered in regard to, and something more like a lot of other diseases that people have.
Yeah, and there's a lot that we can do to manage a condition and live, as you say, healthfully, maybe not absolutely at full A1 health, but to be as healthful as possible despite living with this disease.
Yes, and I think one of the things that adds to the misconception is that, of course, a lot of the things that people witness in terms of what happens to their friends and loved ones when they get cancer as being them going through a terrible time, an awful lot of that is actually going through the difficulties of the treatment, which there's all too little is done to support people and to help them in going through those treatments, of which there are an enormous number of things they could do, which are not being done. And that actually the suffering with cancer very often comes right at the end, not long before people die, and they do suffer greatly, there's no doubt about it. But until that point, people can be very well if they're well supported, which, I think is not really appreciated by the wider public.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's a lot of things that people can do as they're going through treatment, in terms of their diet and nutrition, that can help lessen the effects, the side effects of the chemotherapy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think this is where people can become empowered themselves, as they're not being offered this kind of thing. That I'm glad to say that, we're busy putting out the information that there is an awful lot you can do to help yourself, contrary to the myths. And, some of them are very simple.
Yeah, very simple.
So it seems you're primarily interested in changing the way that healthcare professionals operate by giving them these new communication tools. But they also need to understand the reasons for using them. These two are kind of related issues, but they're separate. And it's clear that whatever tools they've got in the box, it's crucial that they want to and they choose to use them. So to try and change this aspect is actually you're up against the culture of healthcare. It's an altogether bigger challenge than the just passing on the tools. So what do you see as the ingredients for success in making this change?
Wow, I think it starts with the training that they get when they first start in a new field. But I think it's also about it being enabled to continually learn and develop because things change so rapidly.
Yes.
And I think you're absolutely right when you say it's a cultural thing, because it's so easy to be dragged down by and stuck, if you like, in the status quo.
Right.
If you have people who are negative around you, it's very easy to just adopt that negative attitude. Whereas I think what we need is a core group of people who are going to say, no, I don't want to be like this. I don't want to serve in this way. I want to serve in a way that's more positive, and take that stand. And then it'll flow there. In terms of the patients, though, as well, that's another difficulty, is getting them to choose to live well with cancer, because a lot of people you'll hear say, well, I don't want to give up my chips, or I don't want to give up alcohol or whatever. And I think there's this misconception that you have to go on this extreme diet and live the life of a hermit just to be able to survive, and it's not true. But you can make simple, small modifications to your diet and lifestyle. But it's about wanting to do that,
yes,
and making that choice.
Yeah, well, from my own experience, this is an education issue, isn't it, that one? You know, my goalposts have moved significantly over the years that I've been doing what I'm doing. Just because I've become more educated, things, you know, that didn't bother me that much when I started out, like what was underneath in my bathroom cabinet, I didn't set too much store by that. I now am extremely picky about what I have in my house, you know, all the way across all the cleaning products, all the personal care products. I vet them very carefully, and this is because I know more. So I think, yeah, that is an issue of public education, and I'm glad to say there's more of it about now, that the good information about what matters is much more available now.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot more people who have been through cancer themselves and have just taken it upon themselves to share what they've learned with the world. And in this world of the internet, it's easy to do that, isn't it? And it's fantastic that we can have access to so many people and communities that are, you know, inspired to change.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a major factor, really, in many ways, in what's happening is the explosion of social media. It gets lots of bad press these days, social media. But one of the good sides of it is undoubtedly information sharing. And, you know, there are so many quite often high quality Facebook groups now that are carefully sharing good information amongst themselves, which is hard to come by. By other means, and it's an amazing thing, A, for the information, but B, for the personal support that people get from it, because it's like this is the loneliest journey in the world, you know, for a lot of people, and you know, for them to feel that actually they're not a complete nutcase, there are actually lots of other people out there who think that diet and lifestyle has got a lot to do with cancer, and they're with them, which is a fantastic thing.
Yeah, and also particularly for those who've got very rare diseases, it can be especially hard if you're the one in 100 million in the UK who's got a particular disease, to be able to connect with somebody across the other side of the world who's got the same condition, and to understand the difference in the treatments that they get given as well across the different parts of the world, I think it's really empowering.
Definitely. So I watched a video you made last year, and I noted the lengths you went to support professionals in what they do rather than being critical of their shortcomings, which is brilliant. Of course, you know, they are up against it in so many ways, as we've already discussed, anybody working on the wards. So then you wrote a blog post more recently in which you discuss your own video, and you're very specific about advising healthcare workers what not to say to cancer patients. And that advice is based on well-known actual practices in oncology. We've just done a survey, which is not fully collated yet, but is packed with shocking stories of what they've been told and how they've been treated within communications with oncology workers of one kind or another, but predominantly with oncologists. So it's a delicate matter addressing some very common disrespectful and uncaring ways of communicating, whilst at the same time keeping a perspective on the conditions that these professionals operate under, and to see the ways that they see their own aims and practices. How do you think we can manage this?
With great care. The content of that particular blog post was a mixture of things I had read, but also I had many, many, many conversations with different patients across different parts of the world, actually, and there were certain common threads that came out. And I think, how am I going to say this very carefully, the people who need the help and need the training are the ones who won't necessarily access it because they don't think they need it.
Yeah.
So how you access them and how you encourage them to take the training is that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
Yes.
And I find this with students as well at university. The ones who need the help and the additional support and the additional study support are the ones that don't take it up. And the ones who are really good students already are the ones who are so keen, and that's why they come along.
Yes.
And it's an age-old conundrum. I guess there's a phrase that an old colleague of mine used to use. He said, "You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink."
Right.
But he believes you can lead a horse to water, and it's our job to make it thirsty. So finding a way It's great, isn't it? Finding a way of getting them to want to change, to want to level up their practice. And so you might have noticed in my and during the launch period when I launched my course in February, I talked about developing exceptional standards of cancer care, because I believe that at heart, no matter who we are, we're human beings, we want to do the best we can at the job we're doing. Especially people in caring professions. Even no matter how many years they've been in it and how jaded they are and how overworked they are, they still want to do a good job. And so I think tapping into that is probably where it starts.
Brilliant. I agree. That sounds really good, because you're absolutely right. You can put on your fantastic course that you've done, but you know, the people who are really out there causing the mayhem won't come along. Now, Patricia Peters has been into hospitals and given amazing talks, and she talks to a load of nurses who think it's fantastic, and the oncologists don't turn up. That is what happens. So I think you've really put your finger on something important there. If you tap into the desire to be excellent at what you do as being the motivating force, I think that could well be a key to this. I mean, the other thing that's happening, I mean, if I look at the world of GPs, which is changing quite rapidly, especially in comparison with oncology, they are, you know, there's a movement afoot to get nutrition and lifestyle as being a, you know, really a major part of what GPs work with, you know, a whole new toolbox, if you like. And so they're of course, they're looking to bring that kind of thing actually into GP training, which is the ideal, where it's introduced very early on and it's just a normal part of what you do. And the same could be said to be true of oncology, really. It would be actually great to have your kind of training included in standard oncology training.
Fantastic. If you know how to get it into the NHS, do tell me.
Well, I mean, you...
I am in touch with somebody who works in the oncology department over in Birmingham to talk about how they access their training and development needs. So they tend to provide it in-house, but this is certainly something that I see as a need. But how you convince the NHS to take that on board is well, I have no idea. So.
Right. Well, I mean, that is very interesting. Obviously, some people, as in the GP area, they have got some ideas and they're doing it. So there might be some useful cross-fertilisation here. You've obviously developed the material that's needed, but it's not being delivered maybe at the point that you'd ideally like it to be. Maybe we can do a little bit of useful connection making here. And
Absolutely.
I will see what I can do. So we were talking earlier on about age-dependent relationship to embracing new ideas, and but we were talking about patients at that point. Now we've also got the same thing in amongst the professionals. So you know, there is a general feeling that the younger doctors seem to be right up for new ideas, such as more collaborative ways of working with patients, or bringing in lifestyle approaches to complement or even as alternatives to traditional oncology methods. So I was wondering, you know, what your experience is. Do you find it something that professionals are more interested in if they're younger?
That's a hard question to answer without giving sweeping generalisations. Perhaps, although my students so far range in age quite significantly. So I'm not sure I'd have an evidence-based answer for that, let's put it that way.
Okay, no, that's fair enough. I mean, the other thing that's quite interesting and notable to me is that a lot of the major movers and shakers in changing attitudes towards, particularly towards lifestyle medicine, have a different cultural background to ours. They a different heritage. They quite often come from, say, an Indian background where healthcare doesn't actually look the same. You know, they've actually grown up in an environment where healthcare has looked different and has embraced more ideas. I was wondering if this is something you've noticed at all, whether it applies at all in the field of oncology.
Again, I'm not sure I've got enough evidence to support an opinion either way, although it does make sense looking at it from a logical perspective, because if you've grown up say in Eastern cultures, you are more aware of Eastern medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, and yeah, holistic therapies as well.
Yes.
Whereas I think in the West, we can be quite closed to these new ideas. I think it's more than just cultural, though. I think it's also almost intergenerational, and there's going to be socioeconomic impacts on there too, isn't there?
Right, right. Anyway, it's you know, I'm watching for these changes all the time, and I'm always interested to see, well, where are the soft spots, if you like? Where is change more possible than elsewhere? It's no good always just looking at the people who are very intransigent, mm-hmm. the people who don't want to change, who actually rather things didn't change. You know, you inevitably have to go for the places where your message is more easily received. And so that's what I'm looking out for all the time.
I suppose it's like the early adopters in a marketing model, isn't it? Those, you have a tipping point where after so many people take it on board and accept this new way of doing things, eventually your late adopters will say, oh, okay then. And then you'll have a long tail of people who just don't want to change at all.
Yes, yes. So we've talked about your program in terms of you're primarily targeting professionals, but you've mentioned mm-hmm. already that some of the people who come and do your training aren't professionals, and your blog seems to be mm-hmm. quite patient orientated at times, with lots of diet and nutrition material,
at times, yeah.
articles on mental and emotional challenges. So I'm just interested, like, going forward, what are your plans in terms of dividing up your efforts between patients and professionals?
Very good question. I'm still exploring that answer. I have felt prompted quite a lot over the last month or two to do something for patients, and having put in such an awful lot of effort into my course for professionals, I don't want to abandon that. I think eventually there'll be two arms. I'm still exploring what that will look like, but as you can see, over the last month I've been putting on posts that are more patient orientated.
Yes.
Partly because I want to do something that they can use as well. And I acknowledge that a lot of the people who view my page and comment on my social media posts are patients themselves. But yes, I don't have an answer for you there yet, I'm afraid. I don't think it'll be a course. I've got an idea for a book, to be honest. A book with maybe some coaching available for people who want to use it, but it's still in its nascent form in my head. It's not really anything more than a thought.
Right, okay. Well, very interesting. I mean, obviously, I'm very excited to be talking to you and to find out about what you're doing for the two particular reasons. So there's quite a few people who are putting out information to patients now, so that's a great thing. But it's particularly interesting when it comes from somebody like you, who's got a totally science researcher background. So that's one aspect which is great. Also, it's the fact that you're within the profession and you're working with the profession as well. It is, you know, we are in a position of being essentially outside the profession. We're trying to bring people together. That's what our main task we're trying to achieve. But nonetheless, from outside the profession, it can all be a bit impenetrable. So to have somebody like you who's working within the profession is exciting, and it's an immediate place where you know, we can create a link into the profession through you and to other fields as well. So it's brilliant from our point of view, and it's a different kind of force, if you like, to ours, which is essentially outside.
Mm. Yeah, that's a perspective I hadn't considered. Mm-hmm. I would say it's thanks to Yes to Life, actually, that I got into this, because
really?
When I started exploring alternative and complementary therapies and looking at what's available on the internet, there's not a lot, to be honest, that's, I would say, strongly evidence-based. And then I was looking to find people who were in that field, mm-hmm. and it was on the Yes to Life directory that I found a few people who I was able to contact and emailed and, you know, spoke to them about their experience and sent a survey out to them. So, and it was very much, the Yes to Life was the only UK organisation that I could see that was open to integrative oncology at the time that I started looking. I'm not disparaging other organisations that exist. Certainly there's been other ones since that have come on board. Like I spoke with Michael Lerner of yes. Commonwell probably right. about 6 months ago. Yeah. And he's launched a website called Beyond Conventional Cancer Therapies, mm-hmm. where he It's wonderful, actually, because he goes into all the evidence base for a huge range of different complementary therapies. Right. So that's where I point people to if they want to know about the evidence. I say, look at his website.
Well, because he's one of the very early pioneers with his Commonweal. He's, mm-hmm. I think he came over to Britain, was very impressed with mm-hmm. what was going on in Bristol at Bristol Cancer Care, as it was then, back in the 80s, I think. And he went off to set up mm-hmm. the Commonweal, and he wrote really a groundbreaking book at that time, which is now is very old. But nonetheless, the thing that was very clear about it was that in contrast to a lot of the other material being put out at the time, it was very evidence-based. And this kind of evidence-based, it's grown and grown and has enabled us to build some common ground, which just wasn't mm-hmm. possible before. And it's this common ground, which now comes under the title, as you said, of integrative oncology, is so important because this is the ground where common sense can prevail and the patient yeah. can actually be put first and not just subject a part of an ongoing war.
Yeah. I think what needs to happen is a lot more randomised controlled trials as well, because I think where we will struggle in integrative oncology is that the hardcore scientists will say, but you can't say that is categorically because they tried this therapy, because typically people who embrace complementary alternative therapies don't stick with just one. They'll change a lot of things.
Exactly.
So you can't rule out the impact of, say, their diet changes or getting more exercise or whatever else they've done. So and we are complex interconnected systems. We're not just, you know, a bunch of cells in a flask. It's really hard yeah. to pick apart all the different confounding factors. But I think as time goes on and we get more studies being performed, it will make it easier to look at the evidence.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's also an interesting subject, because whereas I think there's always going to be a place for the randomised controlled trial, that as being the kind of gold standard is under question at the moment as well, of course.
I know, isn't it?
And
yeah.
And it largely supports the model of healthcare that is run alongside, which is the drug-based intervention. That style of healthcare has gone hand in hand with that method of trialing. And as you pointed out, it doesn't actually suit other forms of intervention very well at all. It's okay for some, you know. Mm-hmm. There have been some great trials. Mm-hmm. I've had a couple of brilliant things on my show recently, which have been looking at a single intervention of adding high-dose intravenous vitamin C to standard therapy, where it's quite clear, you know, you can see there's a difference. And the same with a vitamin E derivative, which is a Danish trial. Fantastic results of doubling of life expectancy in late-stage cancer patients. I mean, this is the kind of stuff to die for. Not a good phrase, but but you know what I mean. Yeah. It's such important information, and it is... that's something you can do a controlled trial on. But, you know, there's a big case now for developing new forms of trialing, which are more real world and embrace more types of approach.
Yeah, but also standardising the way in which things are measured, because that's one of the problems, certainly within exercise and cancer. The different studies that are done, you can't, it's like comparing apples with pears. You can't, because they're just so different the way they've measured things. And this is where it starts, isn't it? We're constantly evolving. But I think also something that strikes me is that we can be quite willing to take a drug because it's been backed up by a trial, but unwilling to do things like get more exercise because, they've not got the evidence. But actually, exercise is not going to do you much harm. If anything, it's going to help you. It mobilises your immune cells. It does all sorts of good things for you. And then also the number of patients who will take a vitamin supplement because they believe it's going to help them, but they refuse to give up smoking. And you think,
right.
We know that can increase your risk. Why not? Why are you doing that?
Well, that's absolutely fair enough. I think you raised a very important point there, which is this issue of quite often things that are being compared, you know, they're saying, well, this is a proper evidence-based treatment. And because it's a chemical that's given in the wrong way could damage somebody, it certainly needs to be. Other interventions are, they're pretty much come under the heading of common sense. You know, the risk factor is close to zero. And therefore, to require the same level of evidence for those two things before they're taken seriously doesn't make sense, really.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's why I take a viewpoint, and I say this inside my course, that if a patient is seeing results with a therapy where there isn't an evidence base, but it's not doing them any harm, and they're not doing it instead of conventional treatment, you know, they've not completely declined it, although that's another conversation all on its own. I said, I don't think it's, if it's not doing them any harm, then is it really our place to tell them to stop doing it just because there's no evidence base?
Right.
And it's a question I pose rather than my opinion. Yeah,
right.
But
good question.
Obviously,
though.
My opinion is inferred there.
I was wondering, out of interest, whether you're aware of the Alliance for Natural Health's blueprint for health sustainability. Have you come across that?
No.
Well, it's quite new, and I strongly encourage you and listeners to take a look. I think you'll find it extremely interesting. It's a very, very broad look at healthcare and the problems we have. And a very comprehensive proposal for solutions that actually address all the different problems that we're facing at the moment. Anyway, it's definitely worth a look. So, okay, great. Well, look, I'm really enjoyed talking to you because it is so great to find somebody who, like you, who's a science-based researcher, but you're interested also in this. A lot of the same issues that we're working with, the stuff that a lot of people want to know about, like, you know, diet and exercise, the role of the mind, the spirit, the emotions, all this stuff. And it's also particularly great to see you talking about hope and the importance of that in people's health and well-being. I saw you were recommending Kelly Turner's fantastic book, Radical Remission, which I think is a brilliant thing for people who are feeling hopeless, you know, they just need to read. Well, look, this is actually what's possible. And these are the kind of things that people set as important in their recovery. So that's a real toolbox of useful information in there.
It really is.
Yeah. So given all that, I feel very much on the same page with you and your efforts. I love what you're doing. And I'd just like to finish off by hearing what you think about this sort of the gathering momentum that there may or may not be within the professional side of cancer care. Do you think that we're at the beginnings of some real change?
Do you know, if I ask my gut instinct on that, is yes, I think we are. Okay. I believe that, this is going to sound really grandiose, but I believe that I'm part of something bigger, and it's not about me. This is just my little corner in which I can make an impact.
Right.
And I believe in numbers as well. And so I think as we gather people together who have got shared values, shared beliefs, then we can start to make an impact and start to make changes. And there's always going to be naysayers. There's always going to be people who don't want to change because we are human beings and we don't like change.
No.
But as we, as a few early adopters start to take on this new mindset, this new approach to cancer care, then I think eventually we will see this tipping point occur.
Hmm.
When that happens, I don't know. But yes, I believe we're at the start of something big.
Excellent. Well, I feel just like you, we're part of something much bigger. I think there is a worldwide movement, actually, because as you pointed out, the problems we experience in cancer care are not, they're not restricted to the UK. It's the same everywhere, funnily enough. You know, lack of empathy and things like that in healthcare. They're rife all over the planet. And So I think we're at the beginning of a big change as well. I think it's accelerating quite quickly in my experience. Yes, life has moved from being rank outsiders when we started 15 years ago to feeling like, you know, well, we're very much talking common sense to a lot of people in healthcare. So that's a huge, huge change in actually quite a short time in healthcare terms.
Yeah.
So I'm very optimistic.
And in the age of the internet, I think things will only get faster.
Right. Let's hope so. All right. Well, look, it's been lovely to talk to you today, Vary. Thank you very much indeed.
It's
been a
real pleasure.
And this has been a brilliant interview, and I'm sure a lot of people will have enjoyed it.
Lovely. Thank you very much for your time today. I've really enjoyed talking to you too.
It's really exciting to come across scientists prepared to engage with integrative medicine in the way that Vari is. If you'd like to hear her talk about the role of exercise, she's a speaker at Why is Moving Medicine in Loughborough on the 23rd of May. A link to this is on the Yes to Life website, along with other links to material mentioned in the show. Just go to yestolife.org.uk and click the show logo that's on the homepage. A final reminder that Yes to Life has a Cancer Wellness Day in Manchester on the 27th of April, brimming with helpful information from four top experts in integrative medicine. Go to the Yes to Life Facebook page or to the Yes to Life website events page to find full details and to book. Many thanks for listening today. I hope you'll join me again next week. Goodbye.